Well, it's wonderful to be here. This is a fabulous institution. It's fun for me. Two of them, my fellow graduate students, are connected to this place. Phil Anderson, who's sitting right there, and Walter Cohn, whose building this is. You can imagine what it's like to sit in classes with guys like that. This is the title of my talk, and I'm going to be talking about experiments that have been carried out by my co-authors, Jürgen Haase, who is now in Stuttgart, and he did most of the experiments, but also Raivo Stern, who is in Estonia, and Craig Milling, who's just finished his PhD, and of course, samples are enormously important, and you can't do experiments without them. And these are the people from whom we have the samples. Most of what I'm going to be talking about today is actually connected with LISCO, although I'll show you some things from IBCO as well. And we've had enormous help from many different people, who many of them theorists, other experimenters. This view graph was actually prepared for last used at a conference at which both Chris, which Chris was speaking, and April 9th at 11 a.m. he was giving a paper which I was advertising in this talk, and so it's fun that he's here, and tomorrow. He and I are supposed to help in the Dog and Pony show, talking about what one learns about ITC from NMR and NQR. Now, it's been known for some time, for those of us who do NMR and the cuprates, that the NMR lines are broader than they ought to be by simple in simple pictures. Now, since NMR measures magnetic fields and electric field gradients, this is it's a way of probing local fields and systems. And so we have been, many of us have seen these widths, and there's so many things to do, you know, with when you enter a new field which has got so many types of samples and things like this, certain things kind of get left aside. And we have been going back and looking at these, and that's really what we've been trying to understand. What causes those lines to be as broad as they are? And in a nutshell, what we find, and I'm going to show you evidence, that the static properties that you measure in NMR are spatially modulated. The amount of the modulation varies with temperature. Gets bigger as you go down in temperature. The modulation length scale appears to be of the order of atom distances or thereabouts. And there's modulation of both spin and charge properties that show up. I'm going to be talking mostly, as I said, about lanthanum strontium copper oxide. We've done rather extensive studies of the optimally doped, not quite as extensive, of 0.1 and 0.2 strontium. I'll show you some view graphs about IBCO, both underdoped and optimally doped. Now, I'm in the midst of a draft here. Blows view graphs. Adopt a different configuration. Here is a picture of lanthanum strontium copper oxide. This is a side view. Here is the copper oxygen plane, the C-axis perpendicular to the plane going up. And in this material, the NMR shows two types of spectra, one from what we call the A site and the other the B site. I'd love a pointer. Thank you. Hi, how are you? The A site is basically what you have in the pure material, and then the doping produces the B site. That's a copper nucleus which is below the strontium, directly above it. They show up in the NMR spectrum. Here's this is the so-called upper satellite. That is, this is the transition from the M equals 3/2 to M equal 1/2 state for the copper nucleus. There are two isotopes, copper 63 and copper 65. There's an A site and a B site of copper 63, and an A site and a B site of copper 65. And you see they sit on top of each other. You have to be able to unravel them. And Jürgen Haase figured out a very clever scheme that enables us to do this. But I'm going to be focusing primarily on data for the A site. What we find is that the B site's essentially the same, but that's just sort of background information for you. And here's an outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'm sorry, I'm going to force you to have some NMR lessons. And those of you who already know it will, of course, can sit and feel terribly pleased with yourselves, because you love it. It's a great feeling in the talk. Then I'll present evidence for the modulation and show you how we know something about what the length scale of these modulations are. And then I'll talk about oxygen data and how we know that both spin and charge effects are occurring. A rather precise method of looking at the data by a method of moments. I'll show you evidence that we have that the chemical shift is modulated for the copper. And then I'll say something about the doping dependence. So some basic NMR. Now, copper is spin 3/2 and oxygen is spin 5/2. I'm going to just focus on the oxygen. If you have the oxygen nucleus in a uniform magnetic field, why you get these equally spaced Zeeman levels, the M quantum number. And then if you have sufficiently low symmetry so that you have an electric field gradient, there are quadrupole splittings which follow a pattern like that, and they give rise to five different lines. In the NMR, their intensities vary, and the frequency at which the nuclear resonance occurs can be written in an expression like this. This is some particular reference frequency, reference compound with oxygen in it, and the central transition, which has quantity n equals zero, has its resonant frequency given by this relationship, and this quantity here is called the shift. It consists of a spin part and an orbital part. The spin part often called the night shift, and the orbital part is often called the chemical shift. In the case of oxygen, the orbital part is very small compared to the spin part in the systems that we look at. In addition to that, there's a quadrupole splitting, and so it's displaced one unit or two units from the center, and the pattern is symmetrical like this. Now, if you had modulation of some sort, or if these values were distributed, if the shift was distributed, or if the quadrupole coupling was distributed, why, it affects the pattern. And you can tell which is happening by looking at the pattern. If you have electric quadrupole spread, so that not all the sites have the same electric quadrupole splitting, the central transition is unaffected. And that you see on that diagram. The n equal 1 and minus 1 are broadened, and the n equal plus 2 and minus 2 are broadened, and their broadening is twice as great. So it's a very simple matter to tell if you have quadrupole modulation. Suppose the night shift varied from site to site, so there's a spread in those values. Well, that broadens all the lines equally. So you can both of these patterns, of course, are symmetrical around the center. So it's easy to distinguish one of these broadening mechanisms. Now, in the cuprates, if we think of this central copper here, it has oxygen neighbors, four of them, and it has four copper neighbors. Now what one finds is that the night shift on the central copper, let's say the field can be oriented along the A, B, or C crystallographic directions, and that we indicate with an alpha here. That night shift that the nucleus experiences, first of all, arises from the copper nucleus, the electrons of its own atom. But it also experiences effects from the first neighbors. That's called a transferred hyperfine coupling, and there's a coefficient B that gives that. And if you were in a uniform material, so that all different sites have the same average spin polarization of the electrons, why then one knows how that spin susceptibility goes in terms of how that spin polarization goes in terms of the spin susceptibility of the material. And that enables you then to write this night shift here in this relationship here. A plus 4B for this, 2C for that, and E for the apical. Now, we can measure those shifts, and that enables us to measure these various combinations. So it just so happens that, evidently an accident, that when the field's in the C direction, this combination here adds almost to zero. But here's some values determined by experiment, just to make you realize that you can think of those quantities as being known from experiment. So we have any given nuclear site. Well, let's see. Let me just, I guess there's one other remark I wanted to make. The oxygen, you see, sees two neighbors, here and here. And the copper sees four neighbors as well as the on-site. And the apical sees only one copper. So this is an important distinction which we'll utilize. And so we get information not just on site but about what's happening at neighbor sites. Now let me show some evidence for modulation. And this has to do with temperature-dependent line widths. And I'll discuss this now. Here's the central transition of the oxygen, the N equals zero line. Now, you remember what I said in my lessons about NMR, is that the central transition is not affected if you have a spread and quadrupole coupling. But it is affected if you have a spread in magnetic coupling. If you don't have a spread, this line should be much narrower than this. And one knows essentially what it should be. Its width is determined by the dipole-dipole coupling to its neighbors. And that would be temperature independent. So these lines are rather broad, and as you come down in temperature from 300 down to 100, you see the line broadens, and it also drops in frequency. This is zero night shift. So what I want you to notice here is that the breadth of these lines is comparable to the total night shift. So this is a large fractional effect that the nucleus is experiencing.
So what does that entail?
Well, I mean, this is in kilohertz in a 10-8 Tesla field. I mean, I could go through and work out what it is, but it's I can't tell you offhand what it is. 50 megahertz.
What's your frequency?
Around 50 megahertz in 8 Tesla. see, I better keep this thing over here. Sorry for all the disorganization up here, but that's got a very effective blower, which blows one's view graphs. They also seem to be having some interesting electrostatic effects. So if you take the line width of the copper or the oxygen, and this is a plot of 1 over the line width, basically. As you come down in temperature, the copper broadens. As you come down in temperature, the oxygen broadens. The transition temperature, this is optimally doped LISCO. The transition temperature, the superconducting state, is right here at 38. So this line narrows when you go into the superconducting state. And then at lower temperatures, it broadens out again. This is the central transition. And the central transition of the copper gets broader and broader and broader, and then it stays down here broad as you go into the transition, into the superconducting state. So that's what we want to try to understand. And the first, so without any fancy theory, what you can say is this. It's quite clear that this material must be non-uniform, because otherwise it'd be a single night shift, and all nuclei would resonate the same frequency. And this is much too broad for that to happen. You're about to say something.
So the high temperature width you would interpret as maybe material inhomogeneity?
Well, it's an inhomogeneity. I don't know what you mean by material inhomogeneity. I mean, it's not an ethereal inhomogeneity.
Is it temperature independent, I guess?
No. I mean, we haven't gone higher than I show you on the graph there, but there's no indication that it's not at room temperature. It's not at the width that you would expect if you had a homogeneous material.
Right.
And there's no conceivable relaxation process. That much.
You can measure T1 and T2, and this width is much too broad for that. This is a static width. So the question now, first of all, is there some way that we can get a handle on over what length scale this inhomogeneity is taking place? I mean, I use the term modulation. I mean, random changes is a modulation. I'm not trying to imply more than that, other than to say that this material is inhomogeneous in this sense. So what one would be interested in knowing is this. If I looked at this copper nucleus, how far away in frequency is that copper nucleus, which is its first neighbor? And if this and that have the same frequency, then that tells you that the wavelength of the disturbance is certainly longer than this. And if these differ greatly in frequency, then we're getting comparable to the distance scale over which the modulation is taking place. So this is the idea. We'd like to compare the frequency of one copper with that of a neighbor. Now, we know how to do that. What we use is a scheme called spin echo double resonance. And let me just point this out to you, basically what one does here. Ordinary, we're doing spin echoes here. You apply a pulse, you apply a second pulse, and equal time later, the nuclei speak back to you. And what's happening is that first pulse puts the nuclei out like this. They move apart because there's a spread in frequencies. You apply the 180-degree pulse. They come like this. And then they come back together again, rephasing at 2 tau. Now, if this nucleus has a neighbor, and that neighbor couples to it, the spin orientation of the neighbor affects the resonant frequency. So were I to flip the neighbor, I would change the frequency at which the nucleus is precessing. So it dephases here, but it won't rephase perfectly because now it's in a different magnetic field. So what I can do is to sit and observe a nucleus and take a flipping field and search in frequency with it until I find the echo is affected. And then I know, aha, that's where the neighbor is. Now, of course, I need to be able to define the frequency of the neighbor sufficiently well, so I use a low-power, long pulse here, which gives me a fairly narrow thing, and I can show you what that looks like in this next view graph. So here's pulse-pulse echo, or we could do it pulse-pulse echo but flip, and if we flip and flip a nucleus, then the echo is reduced. And suppose this is the line shape of the nucleus that I'm observing. Say I'm observing one particular nucleus. And what I did was to flip, not the nucleus I'm observing. In these experiments, I observe copper 65, and I'm going to apply this flipping pulse to copper 63. Suppose what I did, I have this frequency spectrum for the copper 63. Suppose I did my flip in just that little narrow region there. Then, if the wavelength was very long, the only part of the observed line that I would affect is right at the frequency where I made my flip. On the other hand, if the wavelength is short, I can affect the resonant frequency all across the line. So the test is, if I make a narrow flip pulse, do I affect the whole line or just a slice? And that's a simple experiment to do. And here's the result. For the optimally doped LISCO, here's the response. And here is the line shape that you have on the ordinary echo. In other words, we affect, with a thin slice at the center, we affect the echo all across the line in just the same way that the line itself without this flip is involved. So that tells us that the neighbors are as far apart in frequency as typical spaces in the line. So this has to be a short wavelength phenomena that we're seeing. I realize that you don't need to know these details, but my feeling is that having a sense of what it is that we do that enables us to say something like that has some virtue, even though you may not remember this sufficiently well to go home and tell your spouse about it at supper.
Short wavelength phenomenon, you mean?
The spatial wavelength, the spatial extent of the modulation, the distance over which the modulation changes. If you think of it as if you thought of it as a simple sine wave modulation, which of course we don't necessarily. What we're saying is that wavelength is the order of a few atom distances.
But can you conclude from your experiment that it is a periodic oscillation?
No. I just know that there's a big shift. The neighbor is a long distance away, typically, from the in frequency. So now I want to turn to more details of the oxygen spectrum. What I showed you had to do with copper. And I want to talk about the oxygen spectrum. I want to show you that there's modulation of both the shift and the electric field gradient. And not only are they modulated, but there is a coherent effect. I keep forgetting and running that over there. So here is the oxygen spectrum at room temperature in optimally doped LISCO data of Jürgen Haase. Now, that's the usual spectrum you'd have if you had a homogeneous sample. And you can, and I remind you, I pointed out two things. One, you can broaden by electric quadrupole distribution. That gives you this symmetric spectrum. Or I could broaden the lines with a magnetic distribution. That gives you a symmetric spectrum. This is obviously not a symmetric spectrum, and this is a grossly distorted spectrum. This line is much higher than that one. Of course, their areas have to be the same. So this is high and narrow, and that is low and broad, and likewise here and here. Here's what it looks like down at 100. So the question is, what can cause this asymmetric spectrum?
This is
Lampman. Unless I tell you otherwise, what I'm showing you is optimally doped lanthanum strontium copper oxide. Well, I remind you of the relationship which determines the frequency of the resonance. There's the shift, and then there's the quadrupole splitting. And now what we are going to assume is that there's some parameter which causes these to take on a range of values, the shift and the quadrupole coupling. And we make a simple expansion of these parameters in this of these quantities in that parameter and call the magnetic coefficient M and the quadrupole coefficient capital R. I use R instead of Q because I already used Q here. So, but Q, R, you can remember. So R is quadrupole. And then if that were the case, then the resonant frequency has this central value and then this value here, which varies as you vary the parameter. And so we can talk about shapes. So if I had some distribution function of this parameter F, which looked like that, that shape function will determine the shape of the spectral line, which we have, and the coefficients that that go in it. So let's just look at what that looks like. Here's some calculated patterns where we've made this assumption. We just took for the F of H a Gaussian. And for different values of the relative amounts of these, you see how the pattern changes. And they're very characteristic asymmetries that come in this pattern, depending upon how big the quadrupole modulation is compared with the magnetic modulation. So this is an explanation of that very asymmetric pattern.
So the assumption here is that the distribution is the same for both.
That's right. So this is what we would call a coherent modulation of electric quadrupole coupling and shift. When one goes up, the other goes up. When one goes down, the other goes down, and there's a proportionality between them, which is the same at all sites.
And so you're saying you can fit your spectra as well as you can imagine fitting them.
Yes.
Any deviation.
Separate. Yeah. Well, I'll show you, yes, and then, but we actually can get some more out in some instances. Yes, that is, so that's what you need to get such an asymmetry as this. Here's what the spectra of this look like as you vary the temperature. So here we are at room temperature. I didn't bother to put in the 100K. Here you are at 60K. Here you are at 40K. Here you are at 35. Here you are at 20. And here you are at 10. Now, one thing which is interesting about this, we know that this is just above the transition temperature. You notice these are more asymmetric than this. And these ones become quite symmetric. However, the outer lines are broader than the central one. Now, what's happening here is that as you come down in temperature, we have a spin gap, which begins to cause the spin susceptibility to get smaller. So the spin modulation drops. When we get in the superconducting state, the spin modulation really goes to zero. So now all we have left is quadrupole modulation. But we do have quadrupole modulation. Now, if all we had was quadrupole modulation, the central line would be very narrow. But it isn't. So there is still some magnetic modulation in the superconducting state, even though the spin susceptibility has gone to zero. And what I'm going to argue for you is that we believe that that shows that there are some magnetic centers which are in there. You know, it's like doping IBCO with zinc or something like that. And so, because we've got to have a magnetic broadening of this line, but it's got to be something which doesn't just go to zero because of the susceptibility, so it's a separate thing. Now, we've actually, you saw theoretical fits on all those curves, and those are obtained by convoluting our line with three different functions which have widths. One, correlated spatial modulation of the spin and the quadrupole coupling, thing I've been explaining. Then, some localized magnetic centers whose susceptibility doesn't go to zero. And then some localized quadrupole broadening centers. So we say to ourselves, let's assume that maybe we have these present. And then from each of those things, we can assume a broadening mechanism and a line shape you'd have if you had that by itself. And then you convolute them to get the lines. And those theoretical lines that you saw were obtained by such a process. Now, one of the things which is always good to do with magnetic resonance is try to do an analysis by means of moments. And Van Vleck long ago proved some very important theorems. Phil Anderson did important work in this area. They tell us some things without our having to make postulates about line shapes or what have you. So I want to show you some things about that we can conclude by analyzing the second moment, the first and second moments of the oxygen spectra. Now, I showed you these relationships. The frequency at which the apical oxygen has its resonance is determined by a coupling coefficient to the copper, which is just below it. Couples to one electron only. I mean, one magnetic atom only. The planar oxygen is in between two coppers, so it sees a shift which is determined by the spin at those two. Now, if this is the spatial mean, S sub z here, and we call this then just the deviation from that, then we can talk about the mean squared deviation on site, and we're going to assume that that's the same for all sites. I mean, where you just have one thing. And then you can talk about the correlation between the deviation at the central position and a first neighbor. So sigma 0, sigma 1. And in terms of these things, the second moment of the apical oxygen has this coefficient E, which we know, and then this sigma 0 squared. The second moment of the planar oxygen has this coefficient out front, which we know, and it has the on-site term squared, but it also has the cross term between this oxygen and its neighbor. So we're starting to get, that will give us some information about that. So we can utilize this then. As follows. So the second moment of the planar oxygen is given in terms of these coupling coefficients, C and E. And here I'm having the magnetic field in the C direction. That's what that subscript means. So I can relate the second moment of the planar oxygen to the second moment of the apical oxygen, and it has these ratios in it. Actually, here's how the second moment of the planar goes with temperature, and here's how the second moment of the apical, they actually appear to be just tracking each other in this manner. Basically going through the origin. And from this measurement divided by that measurement and knowing these quantities here, we can determine this ratio, sigma 0, sigma 1 over sigma 0 squared. And that turns out to be about 0.1. Now, if you had a very long range interaction, of course it would be 1. I mean, at long range modulation, because neighbors have the same fluctuation. If it was random, at 1 with respect to its neighbor, why, this would be 0. But we could also have a situation in which if I go in this direction, everything has the same modulation, and in this direction it's antiferromagnetic. So this would be minus 1. Oh, I should mention, if it's up here and down here, up here, down here, so it's an antiferromagnetism, then that ratio would be minus 1. So you could have a plus 1 in this direction and a minus 1 in that direction, and then the typical thing would be 0. So we can't tell from this rather small ratio, sigma 0, sigma 1 over sigma 0 squared, being about 0.1. I mean, that could be explained either by saying these are randomly shifted with respect to each other, or they're shifted in this direction one way and that direction with essentially the negative of that. So naturally, we were thrilled with this. So we said, aha, let's do the second moment of the copper. And copper is going to be beautiful because of that B coefficient in there, which couples the central copper to its neighbors. And when you square this, you'll get that neighbor with that neighbor correlation and this one. I mean, you get more correlations. So we were thrilled. And so here's the second moment expression for the copper. So you see it has all these different correlations between different neighbor sites. So that, we thought this was really going to give us great information. Now, sigma 0, sigma 1, or sigma j, has got to lie between plus 1 and minus 1 compared to that, and likewise over here. And it turns out if you put in we already know sigma 0 squared and sigma 0, sigma 1. If we expressed everything in terms of sigma 0 squared, this has got to be less than that quantity there. We know all of those things. And so what we find is that the second moment of the copper, owing to spin modulation, has got to be less than or equal to this quantity. I mean, the equals is the extreme upper limit in which everything, you know, just gives you the right sign. Whereas in fact, it's bigger than that. So that says that we don't see how we can explain the width of the copper line just by spin modulation. Now, I want to remind you, we have not put into these calculations anything about saying that there's a correlated modulation or anything like this. This just says any spin modulation. So suppose there are magnetic impurities in there, which induce spin variations. This describes that situation too. So this says no spin modulation thing can account for the width of the copper. So we've got to have a magnetic modulation, and it can't come from the spin for the copper. And so we think that it has to be that the chemical shift is modulated. And the chemical shift arises from the orbital paramagnetism of the copper atom. Now, if it were a spin modulation thing associated with these long wavelength modulations, which, as you know, when you come into the superconducting state, this thing gets narrower, you might expect that if the copper had that, the copper would do a similar thing. See, the copper goes right through that superconducting transition, through the spin gap, everything like this width. It doesn't see anything. So, I mean, I think this supports this argument. Seems to, as far as we can tell. So that has to mean that we think that there is there's an orbital modulation here. I just want to point out to you that this is a big effect. Here's the copper NMR line. But this is the central transition, so no quadrupole broadening. This is entirely magnetic. Here's the room temperature line. Here is the chemical shift of copper chloride, which is what usually people take as a zero for chemical shift. And here's the chemical shift up at high temperature. But look how broad that line is, and then it comes right in close to this. I mean, this is a whopping effect. So we conclude that there has to be some orbital modulation taking place.
But this orbital modulation can be on a long scale. We haven't studied the spatial dependence of this modulation.
Well, we have, because we did the spin echo double resonance on copper.
Oh, I thought there was a problem.
No. Now, we'd love to do double resonance on the oxygen, but the oxygen couplings are too weak for you to be able to do double resonance. No, that's a copper experiment. We've got two evidence. Thank you for this question because we have two ways of seeing that there is a in the optimally doped LISCO that the modulation scale length scale is reasonably short. For the copper, we have the spin echo double resonance. For the oxygen, we have the fact that sigma 0, sigma 1 over sigma 0 squared is about 0.1. And so those are two independent statements that this modulation scale must be.
And since the fluctuation, the language is dominated by orbital, then you would conclude that the orbital fluctuation was on an
atmosphere. Yes, that's right. So it's interesting to ask how do these phenomena change as you look at different dopings? Here are three different dopings. We've done a lot of studies of the 0.15, and we haven't done as much on the 0.1 and the 0.2. And actually, Jürgen has our samples over in Stuttgart, and probably at this very moment is hard at work extending measurements. But I'll show you some of the things, because pictures say 1,000 things or something like that. They're better than words. So here's 300 and here's 80K for the optimally doped. and see how different the tenth doping and the overdope is. And I mean, it's immediately apparent that there's different phenomena that's happening in these systems. So just because a spectra looks so darn different. And so we've been trying to understand these. Actually, my first comment is that to a very good approximation, we can until we get to the very lowest temperatures, why we can understand all of the line broadening of the optimally doped LISCO by this correlated modulation in which the spin susceptibility and the quadrupole coupling go together. For the 0.2, we have to invoke the presence of some magnetic broadening from sort of localized states. I just put some numbers here. I don't want to belabor this because that qualitative point is the most important thing. But there's some parameters in curve fitting describing the individual things. There's a magnetic and a quadrupole term for the correlated broadening, and a magnetic and uncorrelated. This is like magnetic centers and quadrupole centers, where we simply say let's assume we've got, let's say, a Lorentzian line or a Gaussian line, which has its origin in quadrupole things. And since it's quadrupole, we know how much it broadens each satellite. And if we have magnetic, we know how much it broadens each. And we can take those different functions and then convolute them to get a line shape. And my point is simply this, that it's interesting. The correlated broadening at 300 is not all that different between these two samples. And when you go to 100, it turns out that the correlated magnetic grows in this one, but the correlated quadrupole is rather similar. This ratio of quadrupole to magnetic, which is similar for these two samples at room temperature, changes drastically as we get down to the lower temperature. But the most dramatic thing is the uncorrelated quadrupole, that plays very negligible role in everything. But there is a correlated magnetic thing, and it's much bigger for the 0.2. And you see, I mean, it's really a dominant thing in that 0.2. So I just want to call this particular type of study work in progress, in which we're really trying to do curve fitting. And what we haven't done is taken the 0.1 and the 0.2 down to liquid helium temperatures and into the superconducting state and so on. I mean, 80 K is as low as we've been, and that's what we're trying to do, is extend data there to see what happens. Here is the inverse line width versus temperature. This is the uncorrelated magnetic broadening, and it's that we need. And it's interesting, it fits sort of a Curie-Weiss law. So maybe it's similar to these things like you have with copper zinc. Now, here's the oxygen spectra, optimally doped LISCO, optimally doped IBCO, underdoped LISCO, underdoped IBCO. And my point simply is that one is seeing the same type of asymmetry coming into these things. I've already showed you that one. So we think it's not just a LISCO phenomena.
The lines look a lot sharper.
Yeah, and the quadrupole splittings are different. The sharp, you know, you sort of have to compare the sharpness with the splittings and other things like this. I can't characterize for you now, kind of numerically, just what they are. Mm-hmm. But what we're trying to do is do curve fitting of these things and unravel from it the size of these different things so we can compare them with one another. So let me just summarize. You see these static properties seem to be, they're spatially modulated. The amount of modulation varies with temperature. The length scale is a few lattice distances, and you get two arguments for that. There's modulation of both spin and the charge, because that's what you need to get that asymmetric oxygen pattern. We do see, and yes, you would expect to see it.
For both orientations.
Yeah, we see it for both orientations.
What we think
we're seeing is a modulation of the chemical shift. But look, the only thing, you can argue, where are the currents? These are electric currents. This shows there are currents flowing, which are non-uniform in space. And the currents could be on oxygens, they could be just on coppers, they can be on both. What we're seeing is a very large fractional modulation of the chemical shift, and we've always thought the chemical shift arose principally from the currents which are close to the nucleus. I mean, like, let's say we have a d orbital, and what comes into the chemical shift is 1 over r cubed averaged for D-like wave functions. So we're extremely sensitive to currents which are on the copper and not very sensitive to currents which might not be on it. So we say that the chemical shift appears to be modulated. We have this correlation, and this fits either of two cases, either random magnetic fields or we had a hell of a time with some referees, and we still haven't published a paper that we wanted to because of being hung up by it, because we use the word stripe to describe the fact that if something is not modulated in this direction and it is in that direction, it has a one-dimensional character to it, and the referees didn't like stripes. And we were just innocently trying to describe a geometry.
I can tell you this is not a unique occurrence.
No. We had a discussion at lunch about referees, and that my pals at lunch will understand why I was speaking with such vigor on the topic. I claim that the referees should not try to determine whether or not paper is correct. That's up to the author. That the referee should let people publish wrong things and bear the consequences. this point here, that we know that we can't explain the line broadening and so on that we have for the strontium 0.2 just from this correlated modulation. But for the optimally doped, until you get down to the lowest temperatures, why, it really does the job. And that appears to be almost purely up there. Whether that has any significance, I don't know, but that's a description. Thank you.
Charlie is doing several kinds of evidence recently that the doping, of course the doping doesn't vary from place to place, but the fluctuation, just the Poisson distribution of dopants has the effect giving you a randomly fluctuating doping across the entire sample. Mm-hmm. That because the correlation length is so short,
this imagery really quite appreciable. It gives you like 50 to 75% fluctuations of transition temperature or effective or gaps, say, across the sample, across samples of this film. Is it possible that that's the source of the imagery?
Well, let me say this. First of all, we can distinguish between an A site nucleus and a B site nucleus, okay? And we don't find any difference between them, apart from the average quadrupole coupling. Maybe that explains it, but I'm not sure that I see how that necessarily produces the isolated magnetic units. But let me say this. I'm not pushing an explanation.
Yeah.
I'm pushing a description.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the first thing I would say is that this shows that in a major manner, these, as you go from site to site, what you're seeing is different.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I don't think most of us have thought in those terms as we think about these things. I mean, we know that they're not perfectly uniform, but these are really major inhomogeneities that we're talking about.
Last week, that also indicated that it's quite inhomogeneous, but just apparently because you have one, two, or three dopant atoms within your correlation line.
That was Imai's data. Are you familiar with Imai's data?
No, I haven't seen his recent data.
He was there last week. So
yes, I know.
Analyzing the quadrupole line width again.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
He claims that there are modulation, but on a longer scale, like 10 lattice constant, 10 lattice spacing of the carrier concentration,
mm-hmm.
not the doping concentration, of the carrier.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well,
but that wouldn't explain your data because that's a slower scale than.
That's a slower scale. I can't deny that that's happening.
Charlie, what happens if you look at YVCO 7.0, you know, with no disorder at the donor?
Well, we have a YVCO sample which is supposedly about like that, but it's inhomogeneous, we know. So I have been communicating with Chris about getting a more homogeneous sample, possibly from him. I asked if I could borrow it, and it turns out he loaned it to someone else who hasn't given it back to him. We would like to do an experiment in 1248, which is oxygen doped. And there's Brinkman's group in Zurich has such samples. They don't want to loan them, so we're hoping they will do the experiment, but I'm not sure whether they will or not.
Steal them?
So, I mean, that's really the perfect system, because it's...
Well, there are also these ortho 2 6.50 crystals, which would give you another...
Yeah. To the extent that you can have random phenomena, why the sort of things that people have been suggesting can be there. But no, it's a good idea to try to get a very homogeneous sample, control homogeneity. And I mean, I hope these guys will do this.
So I have this picture now that going through the sample, there are different regions. In some regions, the magnetic susceptibility and the orbital susceptibility are, say, bigger.
Yes.
And in some regions, it's smaller.
Yes.
Do I have the sign in that right, or are they both bigger in the same region, or is it maybe that one's bigger and one's smaller? You have a sign of, you say they're correlated, but I don't...
Well, no, what that means, what they go up and down together.
Together, so
yeah.
In a region where...
So if one goes, if there's an average value of one's 10% higher, the other's 10%
higher. 10% higher.
Yeah, yeah, so they track each other. Incidentally, let me make one other comment about, the inhomogeneity of material. one does have to understand why it's temperature dependent, why it gets bigger as you come down in temperature. And so, and of course, why, you know, is this, well, that's really it. And the other thing which is interesting to us, at least in looking at the optimally doped LISCO, as we come from room temperature down to about 100 K before the spin gap begins to come in, why the oxygen line with and the copper line with, they're tracking each other. They're both temperature dependent and coming down the same way. And one other comment, which is this, a temperature dependent chemical shift mechanism is hard to come up with. Ordinarily, one thinks of chemical shift as being a high temperature, you know, it's a mixing of high upper states into the ground state, and they're usually thought of as being temperature independent. I mean, we really have resisted the idea that there's a modulation of a chemical shift, but we don't see any way out of it.
I mean, it's a supporting evidence for people who think in terms of, you know, orbital currents of interest for theoretical physicists, like
yes,
Fermat,
but
any answers.
So, you know, so I talked to some theorists about this, and they all point out, well, the currents are going along in the oxygens, and there's no magnetic field from these currents at the position of the copper, and so on. So, at least the conventional pictures that are drawn of these plaquettes with currents going around in them wouldn't produce this particular thing. I mean, of course, if what one had was nice currents going around the oxygen, coppers, you know, then that would be great. That would do it for us.
Didn't you say that you would see the same effect when the field is in the plane, though?
Well, I won't say it's the same, but I think.
Well, I mean, that's what the I think that's the zeroth order question is. Yeah. How do you see it with the field in the plane?
Well, our line is there's extraneous broadening of the copper when the field is perpendicular. We can't account for the line breadth either parallel or perpendicular from spin modulation.
But if you say orbital modulation, it sounds a bit as if you might mean, say, alternation or mixing in of z squared and x y. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, that would be the sort of, yeah.
How much would you need?
Well, that's why I showed you these that line width thing, which showed that the line width is comparable to the total chemical shift. It's a big effect.
So how big is that? I mean, 10% of mixing in of Z squared, or?
No, I think it would have, I suppose it would have to be more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can a modulation of the oxygen to copper popping give rise to the same shift?
Well, you know, I can't really answer that. When we first measured night shifts and so on, and we did a very crude little calculation of the chemical shift, which showed there should be a 4-to-1 ratio between the chemical shift when the field is parallel to the C axis, the perpendicular, and that showed that things were that was just a local picture on the copper only, and that just has to do with the orbital matrix element from x squared minus y squared to either x z y z or YX. And there have been some efforts at really detailed numerical calculations of these things. And Peter Meyer, who's in Zurich, He tells me that these calculations that we published are no good. That's, I mean, you know, I just did the simplest possible thing, and that that what we take as the zero of the chemical shift he doesn't like, and so on. So I don't know what to say in response to this. It's very hard, actually, to, you know, if you're trying to talk about something like the quadrupole coupling to an oxygen, you just can't get the right answer if you just deal with the oxygen orbital. You don't know where the boundary is to the next atom, and a lot of the contribution comes from places like that, and it may do the same in these shifts.
If you would allow fluctuation between, say, D9 and D10, or slightly next near D10, is that somehow possible within your experiment?
Sure. But look, the line broadens rather symmetrically, with keeping its average value fairly similar. So and then the breadth gets so great that it almost goes down to zero chemical shift on the low side.
And so you say it's temperature dependent, right?
I mean, yeah, it's absolutely.
These kind of
things
that hurt, what can happen is really that the lattice is changing, I guess. And because the lattice is changing, these effective orbital stabilities are changing somehow. I get the impression that these lattice changes are small details and things of the kind.
So that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So they're seem to be basically broadening around their original position. There's some slight displacement of this, but see how broad that is. I mean, this is basically what conventionally this is the position you come down to when you try to measure the night shift and the superconducting state and go to the lowest temperature. That's just about in here. So that's kind of the zero of you have a zero of no, excuse me, I take that back. That's not right. This is what one ordinarily thinks of as the zero of chemical shift, because these are closed shell ions. As far as orbit is concerned. But this shift, even at room, this breadth, even at room temperature, is already too big in terms of the broadening that we know from the oxygen, the spread that from the oxygen that we know in terms of the spin modulation of the copper.
Is there any plan to go on up to higher temperature?
We not at the moment. We suffer from the perennial experimenter's problem, which is there are many more experiments than there are people to do them.
Charlie, thank you very much.